Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. In 2008, we interviewed a young Montana lawyer who was a candidate for attorney general. He won. In November 2012, he won again, this time being elected governor of the state of Montana. Governor Steve Bullock, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground again.
It's great to be with you, Brian.
Let's look back. There's a fundamental difference between being a candidate for public office and actually holding that office. When you look back to your attorney general's service, what were the things that you learned from that experience that you didn't know going in, let's say? How was Steve Bullock different coming out of 4 years as attorney general as the guy that walked in the door?
Well, in some ways, Brian, I probably thought that I was ready for that job because I had worked in the office under Joe Mazurek for about 4 years and had a real kind of clear vision of what the office was. But by the same token, you know, like this office, even maybe much more, that on the one hand, you never quite knew what was going to come onto your desk that day. And on the other hand, that unlike campaigns, it's such a position of public trust. And as a lawyer, as the state's chief lawyer, not without, you know, really struggling at times, because so many times that office, you'd have to put your personal thoughts on a case aside or sort of your own values, saying that, like, a good example is that, no, I have to try to uphold the constitutionality of a law, whatever, you know, whatever I might personally think of the law,
right,
as long as there's a good faith argument to make from it.
And how about now? You've been 2 years as governor, same question, different job. Expectations, realities?
It was Tom Ridge, you know, the former governor of
Pennsylvania,
and Homeland Security Advisor.
Right.
I had met him while I was attorney general, and he said, you know, you run to win, but you win to run. So you run for office to win, but what you're really winning for is then to run or run government.
Mm-hmm.
And that really struck me when he initially said it, and I've given that advice to others throughout. I thought my lane was a pretty wide one that I ran or swam in as attorney general.
Okay.
And in a relative sense, you know, it's such a small fraction of what it is as governor, in as much as that it can be anything from any sort of side coming. I didn't necessarily probably appreciate as much that the most precious resource I have here is time, and really trying to balance both the time in the office, the time traveling, being able to not have my schedule so full every moment that you can't pause and think and lead, and also making sure that I have adequate time for those things outside of my job.
You have a family.
Yeah, three young kids and those pieces. But thus far it's been, I can't say that every day is wonderful. I don't know that anybody could say in any job every day is wonderful, but it's been such an opportunity of public trust. And certainly am still regularly humbled by it.
Looking at these 2 years, what would you say key accomplishments have been for you most satisfying?
There's a number of different areas. If I go back to the last legislative session, as but one example, record investments in education, fixing probably the only state in the country that fixed a pension system without raising taxes, freezing college tuition, cutting taxes for every business, eliminating the business equipment tax for 2/3 of the companies that pay it, leaving $300 million in the bank at the end to protect us from fires, floods, government shutdowns, then being recognized as a result as the most fiscally prudent state in the nation. But the last 2 years have also been a lot more than about the legislature. I mean, I think we look at trying to make sure that there's more students that have a path to college and making them aware of the opportunities while in high school. Increased dual enrollment, where high school students, which might be the first exposure to college, when it's done in the high school, we've increased that by over 100%. We've really worked with industry, higher ed, our two-year colleges, our state government to say, let's actually come together and say, how do we make sure that, as I'm talking to companies and others, that we'll have that pipeline of talent and trained workers? I look at some of the things that we've been able to do with technology, both in-house and where we still need to go. I mean, putting the state's checkbook online, adding a degree of transparency. We're working in other areas in that. So there's days big and small. I mean, getting the folks around the table to work on the sage-grouse issue. Well, that might not be the biggest accomplishment in the last 2 years, but getting the folks around the table and saying, how can we work together to get these things done, all end up significant.
How about failures and disappointments, something that troubles you?
I certainly had some disappointments out of last legislative session. I think that it's unfortunate that even though majorities in both houses had supported it, we didn't get Medicaid expansion passed. So
we'll talk about that.
Yeah, 2 more years with 70,000 Montanans without health care. I look at the fact that something that I was intimately involved in as Attorney General, and I think the problems are only getting worse, that we need more transparency in our campaign system and our system of elections. I look at times that state government is big by all means, and moving things along, I don't know if it's a failure, but on the one hand, you have to have some patience. And on the other hand, you know, I mean, it doesn't always, things don't move along as quickly as one would like.
You mentioned elections and funding for elections, and if we have time, we're going to talk about that. But in these recent November elections, the Democratic Party took a shellacking nationally and in Montana. What do you think happened?
On the one hand, you could say, well, we're only one of five states in the country that picked up a few seats in our state legislature from the Democratic side. But when you look at the differences between 2012 and 2014, even though the president lost Montana by 14% when I won, you looked at 2014 and 130,000 fewer Montanans voted. And we need to get it. Why is that? You know, why are people staying home?
Let me ask a question about that, because
sure.
I hear people, I talk with a fair diversity of folks. I have people on both sides of the aisle tell me that sort of the attack ad mad dog mentality of campaigns turns off voters. You believe that's true, not true? Any data about that?
When I was running my campaign, I'd said and tried to make sure that if there's any contrasts, it wouldn't be dark and scary music. It would be me, you know, to the camera saying the contrasts. And I don't know if it's just the dark and, you know, the negative ads, or if it's also just the amount of volume that comes in, that I speak to people that say, well, their vote doesn't matter. And that's a problem if they truly are believing that it is all about either negative advertising or things that makes it when their vote doesn't matter. When we had legislative races decided this time by, you know, less than 24 votes.
Right. You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Governor Steve Bullock. Let's talk about the budget. You've recently announced your proposed budget for 2016-17, which will go to a Republican-controlled legislature next month. What are its key components in summary? We got a fair amount of ground to cover.
We do have a lot of ground to cover. I think the one responsibility that the legislature and I share is effective management of the state's money. So we have a number of what I think are significant pieces in this budget, a $300 million investment into infrastructure, ensuring that there's some dollars going for research and many of the sort of job creation research pieces around our state, dollars to put in our Healthy Montana plan, which is the Medicaid expansion piece, some dollars for mental health, which I think is much needed in the state, our Early Edge, our proposal for what 42 other states do, and that's public funding for early childhood education.
That's pre-kindergarten?
It's pre-kindergarten.
Okay.
Also then continuing to manage our money in a way that, I mean, my proposal again says the one thing our Constitution requires is that we actually have a structurally balanced budget and leave $300 million in the bank for sort of the challenges that might come in the biennium or over the next 2 years.
Obviously, you believe that all makes sense. I want to read two quotes from Republicans in response. The first one is Chris Schiff, a Republican Party spokesman. The governor's budget is yet another example of Steve Bullock's penchant for reckless liberal spending, and specifically in relation to your infrastructure proposal. Incoming Senate President Debbie Barrett says, if we have a smaller list and pay cash, as opposed to, I think you're proposing, bonding a substantial part of that, don't increase our debt, that would be a more acceptable way to go for my caucus. Specifically, the Republicans, as I understand it, are arguing we should pay for infrastructure with cash. You're saying borrow money. Can you explain that?
Our proposal does about a third of it in cash and two-thirds of it by taking advantage of what truly are record low interest rates. Now, I think about even from the time that the legislature was here last to now, because the way we've been managing our money, we were able to reduce the interest rates that local governments pay, saving communities $29 million across our state just by lowering the interest rates. The idea that really I'll kind of accept their premise rings a little hollow in as much as on the one hand they say that we should be paying cash with this. On the other hand, to get that structural balance last time, when 200 bills were put on my desk, I had to veto $150 million of expenditures just to get us into balance. I think about even this last year. I mean, money that the State Board of Investments invested had a 17% return, whereas you can borrow money for 4% because of what we've done with our state's bond rating.
So you're saying you can use that spread and save money?
Well, even if it's not the exact same investment, but
understood.
Yeah, it is less expensive at this point. And not that many states can say this, but it's because of the way we've been managing the money. If you're going to make a long-term investment in the infrastructure, it makes sense ultimately to pay it off over the long term. And I'd say that even in the last 2 years, you look at how local governments have been funding their infrastructure, schools. I mean, there's been about 90 different bond programs just in the last 2 years. And even our last legislature, when it came to certain, like, water projects, they were happy to borrow that money. So I don't think at the same time that, you know, the American Society of Civil Engineers are giving us a C rating for our infrastructure, the idea, well, let's just really winnow that list down when there's significant needs all over this 147,000 square mile state, makes a heck of a lot of sense. And I also, you know, recognize that we're 47th per capita in the nation for what our debt load is, state debt load is, comparatively to the rest of the country. I'm not suggesting I want to substantially change that, but I am suggesting when we have infrastructure needs that will provide a return over the long term, and when we have record low interest rates because of the way that we've managed our money, any businessman or woman would do the same thing.
Let's look at another key component of your budget. It includes Medicaid expansion. In a time of federal deficits, significant federal deficits, why do you believe that expanding a federally subsidized program makes sense for Montana?
Well, I think that our Healthy Montana plan, what it really does is takes parts of both a pure private option, which was discussed last time, and pure Medicaid expansion, really comes up with we'd be the only state in the country that has a program like this. It's modeled after the Healthy Montana Kids program. But the idea that, well, we shouldn't do it because it has federal dollars, at the end of the day, and I do think that the federal government could do better managing their money, but our failure to do that not only means 70,000 Montanans won't have access to health care, and that includes 9,500 veterans and their families. It also means our critical access hospitals, those smaller hospitals, are struggling because really of the degree of uncompensated care that's walking through their doors. I mean, the folks that don't have insurance are going to the emergency rooms where it is the most expensive care. And those costs are also shifted to those of us with insurance in the degree of higher premiums. If we don't do it, yes, it's a federally subsidized program, but our tax dollars are covering people in states like Nevada or Arizona or Ohio or New Jersey, states where, with Republican governors that might add some fundamental issues with the Affordable Care Act, but they said when it came to their state and their economy, they needed to do this.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Governor Steve Bullock. In 2012, as Attorney General, you attended a major law enforcement conference in Glasgow, which assessed likely increases in crime that would impact eastern Montana as the Bakken boom headed our way. Home Ground did three radio shows there, one dealing with the horrific crime of child sex trafficking. Since then, Attorney General Fox has focused on the issue and the importance of a preventative educational outreach effort for Montana families as part of an overall strategy. Do you support that concept?
I think certainly educating folks on the ground, it's very, very important. It certainly isn't all that we need to be doing, but it is important.
Democratic and Republican legislators, Jenny Eck and Duane Agnew specifically, are interested in developing a bipartisan bill to deal with a broad issue of child sex abuse and child sex trafficking and educational outreach as part of that package. Will your administration work with them and, I assume, the Attorney General in trying to get something like that through?
Yeah, and even before I was governor, while I was Attorney General, the National Association of AGs, the last year I was AG, the principal focus, the chair's initiative, was on child sex trafficking. And it happens in all different manners all across the country. That is in addition to a number of other law enforcement and structural challenges that we need to be cognizant of and working to do something about in the Bakken area.
My experience is, having followed this, gotten involved after that radio show, that some places there's denial. It doesn't happen in Montana. And I think one could argue that makes it especially important for political leaders to step up and let people know it does happen in our state, at least the beginning of the fundamentals of making people aware.
That's certainly the case in the Bakken, but it's not just the Bakken. Linda Regnier up in the Flathead has been doing significant work on sex trafficking even before there was that much discussion in the Bakken. So it's, you know, some of our most vulnerable and our vulnerable being taken advantage of. Education is certainly a piece of it, but ensuring, you know, we're doing all the pieces, creating the infrastructure, I think, is significant.
You've made a high priority, we were talking a little earlier about it, early childhood education. Some people would argue this is no time to expand any public program. Others say government funding of pre-kindergarten undermines private child care providers. Your thoughts?
I think that we need to actually look at the data. And, 42 states have made these investments. And where actually the more significant investments are occurring is in Republican-led states with Republican governors. If I look at the last year funding increases, those with Republican governors and Republican legislatures, it's like $15 million more than even those with Democrats. And the reason why I think that is because they've seen that these are investments, these are dollars spent that can make a significant, significant difference. Art Rolnick, an economist for the Fed, had come out and said, $7 to $9 return for every dollar that we put into early childhood education.
What's the return? Better performance of the kids?
The return is not only better performance of the kids. We know that by the time a kid's 5 years old, 90% of his or her brain is developed. If you're not reading, if you're not kindergarten ready, you're half as likely to be reading proficiently by third grade. If you're not reading proficiently by third grade, you're four times more likely to drop out of high school. So not only is the investment for that individual child, It's for everyone else in that classroom that actually then the teacher can spend his or her time focusing on the entire class, not potential disruptions. And when they come up with that there's quality programs can actually be $7 to $17 return. It's also looking down the pipe of what are our costs going to be for social services, our correctional system. If we can get the kids off on the right start, where that brain is really shaping and developing, mm-hmm. the societal costs, it goes much beyond that one individual child.
In 2013, you initiated the Main Street Montana Project. Why?
Well, I think that any business that's looking at locating or expanding would actually begin by putting together a business plan. The state of Montana had never really done that. So it tasked a couple of private sector leaders, Larry Simpkins, who heads up Washington Companies, and Bill Johnson of D.A. Davidson, to say, let's actually do this from a bottoms-up way. So they went out and had sessions, I think 7 of them around the state. They got input from every single county to say, where are strengths, where are weaknesses, where does government provide opportunities and obstacles to growth? Put together a plan. The thought was, though, not to just write a report and put it on a shelf, but ultimately this ought to be something that we can continue to build off of, and whoever has the honor of serving as governor, really sort of a structure that we can look toward the future in our state and bringing together a lot of private industry in doing so, say, how can we further build our economy?
Your office's summary, which is very thorough of the project, lists 5 elements, pillars, it says, to success. The first being workforce training and education. And I want to quote a part of it. To meet employers' demand for skilled workers, Montana's workforce development system must align with the dynamic needs of local economies. As the economy changes due to rapid advancement of new technology, education and apprentice and traineeship programs must be able to quickly respond and adapt to the demands of the marketplace. Now, someone might say that makes perfect sense. Someone else might say that in the most fundamental sense, our nation's founders believed that education was about learning the ethical, philosophical, and moral fundamentals of citizenship, not a job skills training program responding to private economic interests. How do you see that?
Yeah, I really don't think that there's a conflict between the two premises. At the end of the day, and I think we are taking good, meaningful steps, and we have a robust university system in Montana with 2- and 4-year colleges, and the ability to turn around and bring employers together and say, what are you going to need as far as workforce opportunities? And to ensure then that these our students can stay in Montana and get those jobs. Now, that doesn't mean, though, that we're also not focusing on the creativity and other things that students should be learning. I look at this budget that we're proposing, and we're making, I think, probably the most significant request in years, at least, if forever, in also research. And saying, so this isn't the tangible, just the here we are now, we're training skilled welders, we're doing some great things, but it's also trying to provide those things where higher education and private business can collaborate to find new things and new possibilities for our state. If you look at, oddly enough, in agriculture, it's university investments in part that has changed our seed dynamics, making both our lands more productive, but also folks coming together to say, how can we take where we are and even expand it beyond?
In response to the authority that emerged under the 2014 Farm Bill, you've taken an aggressive stance toward restoration forestry and collaboration with the United States Forest Service. I believe you signed a first-of-its-kind-in-the-nation memorandum of understanding of cooperation with the Forest Service. Why? Where are you headed with this?
I think that at the state level, the land board manages 5.2 million acres of public lands, and we do it well. We both protect the wildlife, we protect the streams, yet we also manage our forests in a way that can keep our timber mills open. At the federal level, there certainly is frustrations at times, and it's frustrations that I at times share. And we have diseased and dying forests in all corners of our state, yet we're not actively managing some of those areas. So while we do it well on the state side, I want to provide that assistance so that we can do it better on the federal side too. And that is a collaborative. It's bringing all the interests around the table. It's doing it in a way where I don't think what we proposed was aggressive per se. It was saying, like in any other area, we ought to have long-term thoughts of what we can be doing to both preserve forest health and put logs on trucks where logs on trucks ought to be.
In your inaugural speech, standing on the steps of the Capitol, you turned to your three young children and said that you hoped they would come to understand that the work of your administration would be more about their generation than yours. We're a culture that seems pretty intensively focused on today and on what's in it for me. How's your effort going?
Well, I think that continues to be the focus that I have. And even in my budget, I said we have to look at some long-term investments that are going to last much longer than an individual governor or legislator. When we talk about meaningful investments in infrastructure, they're going to reap the benefit of those probably much more than I will. Early childhood education. My kids are beyond that age. But these are investments that we can make for the long term, trying to figure out ways where we can better work together to move things along is something that remains ultimately a focus for when they take control of this state. So I hope we're getting there. I mean, that continues to be my focus. I mean, I've said that if this worked out for 8 years, my oldest would just be getting out of high school when I'm kicked out of the governor's office. So it is intensely personal in as much as what kind of Montana are they going to inherit? Certainly a great place for me to be raised, and I want to make it even that much better for them.
Governor Steve Bullock, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground. We wish you well for the holidays, you and your family. And to our listeners, we hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.